Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today I'm honored to have as my guest Howard Jacobson. You know, the Booker Prize is probably Britain's most respected literary prize, and Howard Jacobson's most recent novel, The Finkler Question, won the Booker Prize this year. It's an extraordinary novel. It's hugely comic, but it's also melancholic and philosophical and paradoxical. And so I want to begin by asking the question in this novel, what is a Jew?
You thought you'd start with the gentle
the
question and then
one.
Lead up to the big ones. What is a Jew? Well, it's one of the things that the novel sets out to ask, and I'm sure it never comes up with an answer. I don't know what one is. I don't know where my being Jewish resides, to what degree I am Jewish. There are some Jews who think I'm not a Jew at all because I don't do the Jewish things of eating carefully and obeying all the laws of Leviticus. I've never been able to do any of those things. I would argue with those who say, well, you call yourself a Jew, you're not much of a Jew. I would say, well, I have Jewish thoughts, and that's pretty Jewish. And then they'd say, well, what's a Jewish thought? And I'd have trouble answering that, but I just know I have them. They're to do with some of the things you've already said. They're to do with rejoicing in paradox. There was a word that used to be used of Karl Marx. People would say Karl Marx thinks he's not Jewish, but he's Jewish. And you can tell that because of that quality of, I think I've got the word right, Spitzfindigkeit. I think that's the word, a German word, which means over subtlety. I don't know whether I am myself over-subtle as a writer, but I love it in other writers. I love the working over a text, the working words around, the sense that nothing is ever finished, nothing is ever sorted out, complexity of mind, seriousness and comedy running together. I'm not going to say that that's the beginning and the end of what a Jew is and what a Jew does, but those are some of the qualities.
We're told that Jews have a quality of soulfulness, and the two characters who are the most soulful in this book are neither of them Jewish, although they are converts, and they are constantly thinking about what to be Jewish is in a way that the Jewish characters do not.
There's part of the fun of it, the fun of the novel for me, writing about Gentiles who want to be Jewish at a time when many Jews don't want to be Jewish. Part of the initial impulse of this book was to try and figure out what it is about being Jewish at the moment, about Jewish allegiances that make so many Jews uncomfortable with them. At the same time as there are many people in the world, we think there has been an increase in anti-Semitism, that Jews are not popular again. All this, I think, is true and fearful. But at the same time, there is a great regard for Jews, a great warmth shown towards Jews, perhaps generated by something in Jewishness that attracts an answering warmth in other people. And I think that's there in some of my non-Jewish characters. There is no greater paradox than that, that some of the most Jewish characters in this novel aren't Jewish.
Now tell me, in America, our Jewish writers are expected to complicate being Jewish. Philip Roth, for instance, but even Isaac Bashevis Singer, with his lustfulness and his almost satanic sexual presences that appear in his novels. Is that true in Britain as well?
Nobody knows what's required of a Jewish writer in Britain. I mean, what, I almost want to say what's required of a Jewish writer in Britain is that they don't be there. But that's not fair. That's not true. Jewish writers in Britain, and there are very few of us, are perplexing to the English. We are perplexing to ourselves because we don't quite belong there. I see myself as entirely English, really, trained in English literature, a teacher of English literature, a lover of English literature, always wanting as a boy to write novels which would sort of fall into the English literature canon. And then I found myself surprised by writing about Jewishly, if that has any meaning, writing about Jews, writing with the music of the Jews in my prose, and feeling as I was doing it that I was doing something alien to English culture that the English didn't want me to do. I actually don't know whether I was right about that. The English might be perfectly happy that they have in their midst someone like me writing away in the English tradition, thinking he's Jane Austen, but using Yiddishisms that Jane Austen couldn't possibly have known, but which I think she would have loved had she known them. They might be perfectly happy. It's me that thinks, am I awkward here? Are they looking at me in a particular way? Am I a stranger? Am I a cultural anomaly? I don't know whether my sense of cultural anomalousness exists anywhere but in me. And that's a Jewish, that is precisely a Jewish problem I'm describing.
I gather that you studied with the great literary critic F.R. Leavis, who had a lot to do with determining what the great tradition in the novel is. What was he like, and were you at ease with him, and are you in the great tradition?
Whether I'm in the great tradition as a novelist is not for me to say. And goodness knows what my old teacher, F.R. Leavis, would have thought. I don't know whether he would have enjoyed the comedy. He wasn't, I think, all that good on comedy. He bridled at Kingsley Amis when he might have seen that Kingsley Amis was, more culturally speaking, more his friend than he realised. It was wonderful being taught by him. I did not feel at ease, no, because Leavisites, as we were called, specialised in never feeling at ease. It was not our job to be at ease. Everything was tense and fraught. It was a measure of our seriousness that we were always fraught. But he was a wonderful reader of texts. To just hear him talking about a poem and why he loved a poem or a piece of prose, it was wonderful. He was wonderful about the words on the page. We used to imitate his accent, the words on the page. The words on the page. And what we were referring to was the fact that outside the page, nothing really existed. He would have hated theory. He died just before theory took. He would have hated all that stuff. So everything was about revering the language. It was about language. And he was a wonderful trainer of the ear so that you just heard what was happening in a sentence. I don't write the kind of books I think he would have liked. I don't think he would have enjoyed my subject matter. I think it would have bewildered him. But I think it would have been clear to him that I write as somebody who has been taught by him, because as I write with my ear on the sentence. Everything for me is the sentence. I don't care what's going to happen next. I don't know what's going to happen next. My attention is entirely on the sentence. If each sentence can live and throb with life, emotional and intellectual life and wit, then my novel is proceeding. The next sentence will grow out of that, but it's absolutely the concreteness of the language at the time one's using it, sentence following sentence.
Let's hear some sentences. Let's hear a part of the Finkler question by my guest, Howard Jacobson.
Just briefly, this describes an elderly widower going out on for a dinner date, not quite a date, with a younger woman. His friends are concerned for him because his wife has died and he's consumed with grief and they think he needs a night out. What's your favourite colour? The girl asks. Mozart. And your star sign? My eyesight? No, star sign. Star. Oh, star. Jane Russell. So had begun Libor's first date of his widowhood. The girl, she must have been in her late 30s, but that still made her a girl to Libor, did not appear to know who Jane Russell was. Libor wondered where the problem lay, in the accent he had not quite lost, or the hearing he had not quite kept. It was beyond his comprehension that Jane Russell could simply be forgotten. R-U-S-S-E-L-L, he spelt out. J-A-N-E, beautiful big. He did the thing men do, or used to do, weighing the fullness of a woman's breasts in front of him, like a merchant dealing in sacks of flour. His date for the evening looked away. She had no chest to speak of herself, Libor realised, and must therefore have been affronted by his mercantile gesture. Though if she'd had a chest, she might have been more affronted still. The things you had to remember with a woman you hadn't been married to for half a century, the feelings you had to take into account. A great sadness overcame him. He wanted to be laughing with his wife Malky over it. And then I... Libor, you didn't. I did. Libor sighed, wanting it to be over, and showed the girl his hands. The flesh, disfigured with liver spots, was loose enough for her to slide her fingers under. It would peel clean away like the skin on a lightly roasted chicken. His knuckles were swollen, his fingernails dull and yellow and bent over at the ends. Then he ran his hands over his baldness and inclined his head. He had always been a balding man. Balding had suited him, but he was plucked clean by time now. The patina of extreme old age was on him. He wanted her to see her own reflection in his pate, measure all the time she had left in the dull mirror of his antiquity. He could tell she couldn't figure out what he was showing her. When he used to present his bald head to Malky, she would polish it with her sleeve. It used to excite her, not just the head, but the act of polishing, as though he were her furniture. It amused him to be her furniture. "You can open my drawers whenever you like," he would say, and she would laugh and cuff him with her sleeve. At the end, when she was dying in front of his eyes, they had talked dirty to each other. It was their defence against pathos. She wanted him to laugh because they had laughed so often together. Laughter had been his most precious gift to her. And now, at the last, she wanted laughter to be her final gift to him. "I'm sorry," he told the girl, calling for the bill. "This isn't fair to you." She was as relieved as he was when they parted.
Howard Jacobson reading from the Finkler question. Now, that becomes the second subject of the book, the relation between men and women. And is it possible, if a Jew is no longer a Jew, is a man still a sexist? Is he permitted to say certain things? Does he come from a certain order in which certain frames of statement have become impolitic, impossible, unacceptable? And so the book is always playing with the reader, making the unacceptable tug at the sleeve and saying, "Oh, you thought that I have something that will disturb you about being Jewish? Wait till I tell you what I think of men and women."
Yes, I recognize that, and I recognize my own impulses as a writer in that, and also just my own as a writer and as a man. To be alive as a man in our time is to be conscious of having to watch one's speech all the time. Properly, most of the time, I perfectly see the reason for it. But to be possessed of any sense of absurdity is to know that to be watching one's manners like this all the time is a strain. It's a strain on one's nerves, and of course it's a strain on language. Having to be careful with language, having to censor language all the time is an impossible burden for a writer. You can't accept it. So you have to play with these censorships. As in there, the thing a man does or the thing a man used to do, which, you know, carries, there's a whole world of social change and almost suppressed anger at that social change, in that, okay, I have to speak like this now because I can't speak like that now. How do you say, without actually saying them, the things you can't say anymore, without just being, you know, a naughty boy? That one doesn't want to, like many a stand-up comedian, you know, here are the taboos, I'll smash them. I want to be more kind of subtle with that. I want to kind of accept the taboo, embrace the taboo, squeeze the taboo, squeeze the life out of the taboo.
I'm talking to Howard Jacobson. He's the author of The Finkler Question, a novel that really gets elbow deep into the taboo against saying that we understand others. Here, the Jews will not understand one another, let alone make themselves coherent to outside society. Any kind of manipulation between man and woman is exposed as exactly that, manipulation. These are characters who are masterminding manipulators. Tell us who the three central male characters are.
There are two young men, Sam Finkler and Julian Treslov. Sam Finkler is Jewish and a philosopher. Julian Treslov is not Jewish, but he would like to be. They were school friends. Sam Finkler is hugely successful. He's a media philosopher. He fails to take his philosophy seriously. So he writes books like, you know, Pascal and French Kissing and How Montesquieu Will Help You Remember Your PIN Numbers and things. There are such people. And he makes television programs about philosophy. But the point about Finkler being, he's a person who finds it hard to stick seriously with anything. He's successful. His old school friend, Julian Treslov, isn't. Julian Treslov has worked as an arts producer in the BBC, felt it was a backwater, no longer works for the BBC. He's now a lookalike. He's so indeterminate, he can work as a celebrity lookalike for everybody. Towering over these two men is Libor, who once taught them, the 90-year-old widower. Finkler, too, I should have said, has lost his wife. Libor was born in Czechoslovakia, came and worked as a school teacher in London for a while, and then ended up as a famous show business journalist. His story, I think, is the most affecting as we watch a 90-year-old man deal with the death of a wife he had adored, truly adored, for 60 years. The question then arises, for Treslov, who is not widowed, would dearly love to have a wife to grieve. His two Jewish friends are both widowers. He's not a widower. He's alone. And he looks from one of these Jewish men to the other, admiring their Jewishness, their warmth as he sees it, their confidence as he sees it, the way they battle each other, these two Jewish men, about every aspect of Jewishness, including Israel, and wishes he was possessed of their confidence, but isn't.
So one takes philosophy unseriously. One takes marriage unseriously. The third takes marriage and Yiddishkeit rather seriously. It's a given that although there are pictures of him laughing with Marlene Dietrich when he was a celebrity journalist or with Marilyn Monroe, that there's no one as interesting to him as his wife Malki. And it provides a kind of standard in this novel, so hard in modern novels to provide a standard, of where the moral center could be if there still were one.
Yes, exactly. This is a world in which everything slips. No one can hold on to anything. No one particularly wants to hold on to anything. Finkler can't be serious. Treslov can't find seriousness. And there, towering above it all, morally, I suppose, I know to put it to myself like that, is Libor, whose love for his wife stands at the centre, maybe, of the novel. It's something that Finkler feels he can't measure up to, and stares at it and wonders what it means, because Libor says, I don't just miss the life I had with Malki. When they talk about, they go into Finkler's wardrobe at one point, and they look at the dresses once worn by Finkler's wife, and they discuss, each of these two widowers discuss the business of the clothes that their wife had. And Libor says, what I miss most is the idea of what Malki might have been, the life with Malki I might yet have had, although she was 80 and he's 90. And Finkler is amazed by this, that he could look forward like this, missing not only what was, but missing a futurity with that woman. And Finkler can't even properly miss the time he had with her. So he stares at Libor as at a fidelity, a loyalty that is beyond him. And Treslov stares at it with a wild sentimentality. Why can't I have a love for somebody as deep as this? But beyond that, there's the other question, which is, has he loved too deeply, Libor? Is he too wounded now by this thing that's happened to him? Is any life now possible to him without Malki? Can one love too much, in fact? Can one be in this world of sliding loyalties and allegiances? Can an allegiance be too deep?
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Howard Jacobson, the winner of this year's Booker Prize for his novel, The Finkler Question. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Howard Jacobson about his new book, The Finkler Question. It's a tragicomic exploration of that impossible question. Is there still, in a world of relative values, enough of a standard to write a moral comic novel? These characters are wildly in pursuit of the possibility of truth-telling, and all they end up with is a kind of Tom Stoppard-like acrobatics of illogic. It's very funny, but are they truthful? Well, each of them will learn he has to give up his dearest belief in order to become a real person, and the person who can give up the most manages best.
I like the way you put it. Whenever one hears one's book spoken about well, as I'm hearing it spoken about well now, I feel a kind of guilt. Did I know all these things? Did I know I was doing all these things? Does it matter that I knew I was doing all these things? No, I think in the end it doesn't matter that I've not put this to myself, but I felt that the novel kept, almost as it were, falling into its own seriousness and finding itself more serious than I even knew it was being for a while. There's one particular scene where Trezalov confesses to Libor. It's a scene in which all I'd meant to happen, really, was I wanted Trezalov to take the older man, the older friend Libor, out for a salt beef sandwich. And I wanted a scene in which Libor would not be able to eat this sandwich. That was all to begin with. But then something happens in that scene. Trezalov confesses to Libor that years ago he'd had an affair with Finkler's wife. He doesn't know why he's confessing this. He's just confessing it.
And it sounds beautiful is the old man says, "You shouldn't have told me."
Yeah.
What kind of a friend are you to have slept with your friend's wife? What kind of a man are you to be telling me that you've done this, when you know that if anything has ever been important to me, it's been the loyalty of my own marriage? And see, all along Trezalov has thought nothing means really anything. Libor, you know, speaks very wittily about casual errors within a marriage. He speaks of it, but is not a practicer of casualness. And this is what Libor has to learn, that life isn't casual.
Yes, I agree with everything that you're saying. And I remember with great vividness how the coldness that crept upon me as this scene unfolded and wrote itself. And only in this scene with Libor does one suddenly realize these are not light things. These are not things that you can just do. Sleeping with someone, even in our free and easy age, is not a thing of no consequence. And it takes Libor, an older man, speaking with an older moral vocabulary, and speaking out of his own fidelity to his wife, the extreme urgency of that fidelity to his wife, to show Trezalov that his own life has not been, and in all its respects, has not been truly a serious life yet. And as you say, and just as he has not taken his friendship with Finkler seriously, he's not taken the relationships with the other woman and the children he's fathered seriously.
Now, somehow it seems as if in the Finkler question, the word Jew has fallen out of the vocabulary. For the hero of this book, Trezalov, Finkler is his prototypical Jew. The Finkler question is the Jewish question. But now, as opposed to being a standard of morality and seriousness for a community, the Jew frequently is joining an organization, one such, the Ashamed Jews. Why are they ashamed? They're ashamed because they are ashamed of the policies of Israel. But they're ashamed of themselves, they're ashamed of their parents. It's almost as if with the disappearance of the Jew and what he stands for in terms of moral seriousness, the whole culture, the whole rondelet of this novel is falling apart.
But one must be careful, too, not to assume that there ever was a world in which the Jew was absolutely this agent of moral certainty or moral goodness. There wasn't. One of the things I'm pursuing in this world is this question. If there are a number of Jews in our world who say today in our society, as there certainly are in England, for whom Israel has become an occasion for them to express their detestation of things Jewish, could it be that that's merely a pretext? Could it be that Israel is just a new symbol, if you like? Could it be that they are simply using Israel in order to give voice to an old, even an ancient, Jewish self-distaste? We're not allowed anymore to talk about Jewish self-hatred. Can't do it. It's talked about just occasionally in this novel, and Trezalov thinks, well, you know, you can't say that Finkler is self-hating. I've never met a man that hates himself less. That's naive. It is possible to be highly arrogant and still be consumed by self-loathing. The thing I'm pursuing beyond Israel and beyond the now is there something in Jewishness? Is there something in the history of Jewishness that's made it too easy for Jews to be repelled by themselves, some quality in themselves. At the roots of Zionism, there was this hatred of the Jew as Talmudic figure, you know, locked away in the shtetls and villages of Eastern Europe, doing nothing but studying, a person of prayer and ancient belief. There was a hatred of that. We must have a new Jew. We must have a Jew who goes back to the land. Zionism was partly born out of this. We must save the Jew from that horrible spectacle of the over-devout Jew. Now it looks as though we must save the Jew from the spectacle of the over-militaristic Jew. Now, one doesn't have to be much of a psychologist to suppose that if after thousands of years of oppression and persecution and exile that you will take into yourself some of the views that those who have oppressed you have of you. And I believe that that's what's happened. And I think this outbreak, because it feels like an outbreak in England, of Israel hating among Jewish intellectuals can't be attributed only to whatever it is that Israel does or doesn't do. It just goes further. The language is too heated to be explained by anything objective out there.
Well, I think, Howard, that in a sense, both of us, when we came to the study of literature, came in default. We would have been Talmudic scholars. And what we're watching, I think, in this book is the sense, can a Jew be described without reference to Judaism, to the traditions and meaningfulnesses that give rise to him? And I think that all along we're watching the slippage of culture from something genuinely difficult and thorny to something social and perhaps a bit trivial. And if there's a comedy in this book, it's a serious comedy of watching people who once would have been serious people, a philosopher, a philanthropist, a moral brooder, become debaters.
I absolutely agree with you. Now, I'm interested in your describing yourself as someone who might, in other circumstances, have been a Talmudic scholar. You mentioned earlier my having been a pupil of F.R. Leavis. When I went to Cambridge to study in F.R. Leavis, I was partly getting away from my sense of a Jewish community, something that was a little bit parochial, and I was coming to the grander world of English scholarship, to the wide open spaces of the English imagination, as opposed to something that felt to me a little more cramped about the Jewish imagination. And it was only 2 or 3 years into studying with Leavis, I thought, the work I'm doing, this close study of the text, looking at what Leavis said about the poem and what somebody else said about Leavis saying about the poem, and now what I say about this somebody else, it's Talmudic scholar. It was absolutely that. So I do feel I'm in that tradition too. So I'm not surprised to hear you saying that my book contains this seriousness.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I've been talking with Howard Jacobson, author most recently of The Finkler Question, published by Bloomsbury. Thank you, Howard, for joining me.
It's been my pleasure. It's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Finkler Question at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is